Welcome to episode 23 of Your Kids Next Read podcast, in which we talk about books and reading for kids of all ages. I'm Alison Tate, author of middle grade adventure series The Mapmaker Chronicles, The Adaban Cipher, and my latest, The Maven and Reeve Mystery Series. And I'm here with my co-host, the superb Megan Daly, celebrity teacher librarian, blogger at Children's Books Daily, and author of Raising Readers, How to Nurture a Child's Love of Books. Megan and I, along with our good friend, author Alison Rushby, are founders of the Your Kids Next Read community on Facebook. Search for Your Kids Next Read there to join us. So, Megan Daly, we meet again. Honestly, it's a highlight of my week, particularly this bit, because I do love to hear about all of the very exciting happenings in the kingdom of Megan. What have you got for us this week?
Okay, well, I've survived the school holidays with four children. I have survived. But I did get a bit out and about. I was able to do a workshop at Brisbane Square Library based on Narelle Oliver's beautiful book, Home. And the children's area in Brisbane Square Library is based on the artwork in this gorgeous book. And it was really great to be able to celebrate her work and to continue to talk about her techniques and her as a person. She was a very, very dear friend of mine and is so very sadly missed. And I love that her family are happy for me to continue to do story times and things based on particularly her book Home. So I just love her work, and it was a real honour to be able to do that, and also to be able to just get out and about and do some workshops with young people. So really enjoyed that.
Oh, that's brilliant. What a lovely way to honour her work as well, to continue. Because that's the thing, you know, you write books, and if people don't continue to read them, to talk about them, to do workshops, and if you're not around to do it yourself, if someone's not doing it for you, then your book just gradually fades away, which I think, you know, is one of the saddest things about books.
Yes, absolutely. So she lives on through her books.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Banging on about them.
Brilliant. And speaking of books, like, I had a very strange week because I discovered, thanks to a Goodreads review, that my Mapmaker 4, which is called Beyond the Edge of the Map, so there's three books in the initial trilogy of the Mapmakers, and then there's book 4, which is Beyond the Edge of the Map. And it came out in Lithuania. It got reviewed.
What?
In Lithuania. It came out in Lithuania, and I hadn't actually even realized that it was out. So I was able to contact my publisher and say, you need to chase those Lithuanian publishers for my author copies. Because one of the great joys of like foreign editions is the author copy. The copies. So I have... and in actual fact, the third book came out, and I didn't even know the third one was out either. So this is how much when your work goes out into different territories, it's often not easy to keep track of what's going on where. And so I have put in a request for my hardback Lithuanian copies the third and fourth books in the Mapmaker Chronicles series. But yeah, I've got them, the others here in Lithuanian, and it's called Kartografo Chronikos in Lithuanian, which my sister hilariously just thinks would be the perfect name for a Bond villain. And I have to say, I kind of agree with her on that. So anyway, so hopefully I'll be able to share some images of those on social media soon. So that's happening. And the other thing is, of course, that school is back, and which strangely feels very similar to school not being back. So Book Boy, who is doing Year 12, is and was supposed to finish like at the end of last term, is back at school waiting for the HSC to begin on the 9th of November, which is the day, like pretty much like it's 2 days after his HSC was actually supposed to finish. So it's it's just drifting. The whole thing is just drifting along. I don't know how anyone could look at this year's HSC and go, yeah, this is just like all of the others. This is a fair representation of what these people can do. But, you know, everyone's in the same situation, so we go forward and that's what we do. But, yeah, so it's an odd feeling because, you know, he, of course, was all geared up for it to be over, and now he's back, and graduation has been pushed back and everything's, you know, and he was planning a velvet suit, I think. for
Nice.
graduation. We have a friend who's got a sensational wardrobe of 1970s velvet suits, and he
Oh,
was going to borrow one of those, but I'm not sure whether that's still the plan
that's
or if
actually going
it's,
to happen.
yeah, I don't know, which is disappointing. But anyway, and we don't get to go to the graduation dinner. It's
So many things.
so many things. But anyway, in the interim, and to bring us joy, we have book mail.
We
And book
do.
mail is always a pleasure. Although I have none, which is highly disappointing when I'm, in this current mood.
I
But
have plenty.
you've got some for us. And so you can share yours, and I will share, and I will just experience vicariously the book
You
mail.
will. You will. Okay, so my first one is a new picture book by Oliver Jeffers called There's a Ghost in This House, and it was released yesterday, so you can all go ahead and purchase. Now, let me preface this by saying that I am not a fan of ghosts or stories which star spooky things. I can hear Alison Rushby chuckling. I'm not a fan of Halloween either. Okay, I'm just putting it out there.
No,
Not
I'm
a
not
fan of
either.
Halloween.
I'm with you, but anyway.
And yet, I do love, love, love this new Jeffers book. It's about a young girl who lives in a haunted house. She has never seen a ghost. Are they white with holes for eyes? Are they hard to see? She would love to know. Step inside this book and turn the transparent pages to help her on an entertaining ghost hunt from behind the sofa right up to the attic, with lots of friendly ghost surprises and really amazing mixed media
That
illustrations. So
sounds incredible.
it's beautiful. Each page has a transparent sheet between it, and it's actually very, very clever and very beautiful.
Wow.
And the small bees absolutely loved it. And the ghosts are super friendly, so all is good in the land of Megan.
Do you know what I find fascinating about, and I know we do talk about how incredibly clever some of these, particularly, picture book artists, because it's a conceptual thing. Like you've got to think of the concept, and you've got to go to the publisher and say, this is the
This
book I'm going to
what
write. We're going to need transparent sheets between each page. We're going to be, and I'm just like, I it just blows my mind that people think visually like that. I just find it extraordinary. So that sounds great.
It's really fantastic. And then in a similar vein, sticking with the kind of Halloweeny theme, seeing as we get to that, getting to that territory in some people's world, not mine. I've got The Last Kids on Earth and the Doomsday Race by Mac Brailer with illustrations by Douglas Holgate. Now, this is a book for readers from sort of 8 plus. It is the seventh book in a series, and it's sort of like Wimpy Kid meets The Walking Dead. It's got monsters and zombies, and the small bee who is 8 assures me that the book is suitable. So I have not read it because zombies and monsters, but it is also an Emmy Award-winning Netflix series, and I'll read you the blurb. With his zombie-controlling powers growing stronger, Jack Sullivan and his buddies are road tripping towards the mysterious tower, where they must once and for all stop an ancient destructor of worlds from descending upon our dimension. But their journey is sidetracked when they are swept up by an enormous centipede monster carrying the world's largest shopping mall on his back. Told in a mixture of text and black and white illustrations, this is the perfect series for any kid who's ever dreamed of starring in their own comic book or video game.
Well, and like, who doesn't dream of that when you're 8?
Yeah,
Like, really?
I know.
Yeah, that's what you're there for, isn't it? Speaking of spooky stories, though, and Alison Rushby, because I mean, we spoke last week about Marcy Gill and the Caravan Park Cat, and how it was that lovely, gentle, and we're like, Alison Rushby would love this because she is that, and she does love that, but she also loves kind of spooky, scary stuff.
Yeah,
Like we read, she
does.
recommended a book to me a couple of years ago. I think it was called The Call, and I read it and I was like traumatized by it. And she thought it was hilarious because it's a YA novel. It's just like, I can't read this. Because she does have this, and I think that's what makes her book so amazing, though, is that she combines those things, that
Yeah.
slight edge of the
Spook.
stuff that you and I don't like to read, with this amazing kind of classic feel, gentle sort of, other stuff that she does. She's anyway, so that's Al Rushby. Let's just give her a big up right there. But she also wrote a book list for me a couple of years ago, for my for my blog, which is called 10 Spooky or Scary Middle Grade Books for Halloween. And these are books that she recommends for middle graders who love that sort of supernatural kind of ghosts, graveyards. You know, she's got books with ghosts and graveyards and evil trees that steal little girls away on the eve of their 11th birthday, which of course you and I just terrified by.
Not going to be reading, but
lots of kids,
the show notes,
lots
won't we?
Of kids love this stuff. So she often receives the comment from teacher librarians that they love the fact that her books are spooky but not scary.
Yes.
So they're happy to hand them over to middle grade readers who are looking for that kind of safe bedtime thrill. So I asked her if she would, you know, create a bit of a list of you know, spooky reads, which she has. But she also, while she likes the idea that she's not sending small children to bed scared witless, she knows that there are other readers, like the ones like her, who love nothing more than scaring themselves wide-eyed silly. So she's got five sweet and spooky reads, and those recommendations are The End Sister by Penny Rousson, A Ghost in My Suitcase by Gabrielle Wang, Serafina and the Black Cloak by Robert Beatty, Magritte by Lee Battersby, and Ghosts of Green Glass House by Kate Milford. So those are her five sweet and spooky reads, and I will put the link to this list in the show notes, so don't panic if you're trying to get them all down. But then she also offers, just in case, five nail-bitingly scary reads for middle graders. And they are The Nest by Kenneth Oppel, Coraline by Neil
That's
Gaiman,
so scary.
The Screaming Staircase by Jonathan Stroud, Lockwood & Co. number one. This is her number one recommended book
that.
Ever. She loves this series, Lockwood & Co. And I do believe there is now a Netflix series, maybe?
I won't be watching that.
No, me either. But I'm sure she's binged it five times. The Night Gardener by Jonathan Oxier is how I would pronounce it, but I can't be certain. And The Aviary by Kathleen O'Dell. So if you've got sort of young readers who like a bit of spooky or who just are really looking to be terrified, this is the list for you. And I will put the link in the show notes at yourkidsnextread.com. Perfect for Halloween if you're into it.
It is indeed. I'm going to go back into territory that I am much more comfortable in with my third bit of book mail this week.
Okay.
I love food, cooking, and like I'm just a massive, massive foodie. I really am. So yesterday, The Amazing Meals of Martha Maloney arrived in the mail. It is by Margaret Wild and Dan Wild, and it is illustrated by Donna Rawlins. Now, it arrived yesterday. I opened it. I squealed. I begged my 10-year-old to let me read it with her, and then I rang the beekeeper, who was in a truck on his way to a Manuka honey flow, I didn't even really know what that is, to tell him about this absolutely amazing book, because we're both massive foodies, and I've been trying to instruct him lately in what makes the perfect picture book, and The Amazing Meals of Martha Maloney is the perfect picture book. This is one for the foodies. It's the one for the teachers who endure excursions, and it's for the little history buffs out there. It's a really beautiful, glorious weaving of fact and fiction, and it's completely and utterly delicious.
Oh.
Here is the blurb. On a school trip to the Museum of Famous People, Martha Maloney wanders off and enjoys the culinary delights of important figures through time, much to the dismay of her teacher. Readers can experience history through the dining tables of King Henry VIII, Princess Mary Antoinette, and more, with heaped servings of information about each time period and their culinary customs. Now, I have to read you. The teacher is without a doubt my favourite character, and I have to read you this first page. Martha Maloney has been waiting all term for the class excursion to the Museum of Famous People. Her teacher, Mrs. Souza, says, "Jason and Fernando, stop punching each other, and Martha Maloney, let me remind you that eating and drinking is absolutely, totally forbidden here." Mrs. Souza's voice goes on, but Martha doesn't hear a word. She's having a bite to eat with King Henry VIII. And then we turn the page, and we're then with King Henry VIII, who has 700 guests and 240 dishes, including almonds, artichokes, brim, chicken, cygnet, duck, eel, and so it goes on. And it then has this great nonfiction page about King Henry VIII. And then the poor teacher on the next page is saying, Lakshmi, watch where you're going and do not step on those tiles. And Martha Maloney, give me that dripping pie at once and the banana and apple. And I honestly can just... They have, Margaret and Dan Wilde have nailed the exasperated teacher voice. I am so going to love reading this book.
Oh, you are.
And they've nailed The Precocious Child. And Donna Rawlins, the illustrator, has completely and utterly captured the teacher on excursion vibe. She's got armfuls of clipboards, things slung over her handbag. She has sensible shoes. She has a perky little necklace and matching earrings, which I suspected to perk her up on her excursion.
Does she have a streak of pink in her hair like other people I could mention?
She does not. She totally should. That would make her feel much better about being at the Museum of Famous People. But it's just beautiful. And Donna Rawlins and Margaret Wilde did one of my all-time favourite books together, which is Seven More Sleeps. And then I loved also the follow-up, which was Babs the Baby and Fog the Dog. I love Donna Rawlins' illustrations. And, of course, I adore Margaret Wilde. My own girls were gifted Chickpea was gifted Puffling when she was born, which made me sleep. I've spoken about it many times
you
before.
Have, yes.
And I have a piece of, actually I lie, my mother has a piece of artwork from Little Humpty, one of her favourite Margaret Wilde books. And my own favourite Margaret Wilde book was There's a Sea in My Bedroom, which I just adored. Now, I have something exciting about this book to share. I got to the end of the book and I read the dedication. I'm a big fan of reading dedications to the students that I read books to. I love a dedication because it tells you a little bit about the story behind the story. And there's a lovely dedication from Margaret Wilde, one from Dan Wilde, and one from Donna Rawlins. And then there's a dedication from MM, which I won't read out to you. But I was like, who's MM? And I'm looking at the creators and I'm thinking, it's got to be Margaret Maloney, the Martha Maloney, the main character. And I'm like, that's unusual. And so because I knew I wanted to talk at length about this perfect picture book on the podcast, I emailed somebody I know at Walker Books and I was like, hey, Maria, can you just like clarify for me, is the dedication from Martha Maloney? And she emailed Margaret Wilde and Margaret Wilde emailed back and said that, yes, Dan is her son. So Dan Wilde, the co-author, is her son. And this book is based on a story that he wrote in high school many, many years ago. And the dedication MM does, in fact, refer to Martha Maloney because she's such a feisty little character. She muscled her way in with her own dedication. And then she goes on to say that Martha is not a real child, but was based a little on my daughter, Karen, who was a real foodie even as a small child. So I am just here for everything about The Amazing Meals of Martha Maloney.
Great. I love the idea of, you know, like that sort of, you know, turn the page and there's and you, of course, do love a bit of food in a novel. I remember us talking about the first Maven and Reeve book, The Firestar, and you were the only person who said to me, oh, my Lord, I was on board for the food. Like, there's so much great food in this thing. I was like, okay, thanks for noticing. That's brilliant. Oh, that's very funny. And it reminds me actually a little bit of a book, which is more of a nonfiction book that the boys were given, which I actually kept because I use it. It's a fantastic reference kind of idea for me. It's a book called A Street Through Time, and it's illustrated, and I'm looking at it on my shelf. So it's illustrated by Steve Noon, and it's a few years old now, but it basically shows the same street in England, and it shows the same street at different points in time. So you can see it's just illustrations. And so you turn the page and, you know, you're in medieval time and you turn the page and you're in Victorian time and you turn the page and it shows you the change in architecture, the different, like the number of people involved. It shows you like there'll be a square and you can see what's for sale in the square. Like, it's really great. If you're writing, I use it as a reference book. If you're writing and you want to be able to kind of just really get a very just quick picture of what things might have looked at and what where they might be, it's wonderful. Brilliant for kids who love history, like brilliant for kids who love history. Totally different book and not book mail, and I've gone totally off, you know, track again.
No, but it was a nice segue.
You like that one? Oh, good.
I do.
All right. So there's not too much more waffle. We should get to our bingo question. Now, our bingo questions are the questions that come up regularly in the Your Kids Next Read Facebook community. We have nearly 21,000 members now, and so these are questions. There are just a certain number that are regulars. We get them all the time. And this is one that is asked in many different guises. I've kind of like sort of, condensed it down a bit. But it's basically, should I discourage easy reading? And it's essentially that question where people are worried because their child, their young reader, keeps reading things that are what the parent or carer or, whoever the adult is in question, thinks is too easy for them. And they feel like they should be challenging themselves more, but they keep going back to reading these, things that are too easy for them, or they will not move on from the things that are too easy for them. And so, I mean, I've never really discouraged easy reading. My 14-year-old son still goes back to Wimpy Kid on occasion, or various things that he's read, or he will pick up books that I have had on the shelf there for him for years that he has never looked at, that are probably more of a reading level, of the 8 to 10. He reads at a much higher level than that, but I'm so happy to see him with a book in his hands that I just go, yeah, great, whatever. I mean, obviously, I do like the fact that he reads other things as well, because I think when you continue to read books that are what you would be a few levels below where you can read, it's just it's more it's about for me about that sort of vocab sort of expansion and more sophisticated storytelling styles and things like that. So I do encourage wide reading, but wide reading for me takes in easy reading as well as a whole range of other different types of books, non-fiction, more challenging reads. A bit of a classic, as we discussed a few episodes ago, if you think the kid is going to be interested in that particular book. But what do you, I mean, what are your thoughts on it? Do you discourage, I mean, parents tend to be more worried about this, I think, than teachers or librarians or anybody.
Because I do get asked this quite a lot by parents at school in my role as a primary school teacher librarian. And look, sometimes I've looked at my own kids and I've thought the same, but I would say that I never discourage it because, like you say, all reading is good reading. And I think that what you might classify, or not us, but people might classify as easy reading, can actually be seen as comfort reading. It's like reading about your familiar friends. For example, I'm just looking at my shelf at the moment, and my 10-year-old is a great reader, but she absolutely loves reading the What Zola Did series by Melina Marchetta, which is aimed at sort of 5 and 6 year olds. But it's just such great writing, and she finds great joy in finding out and rereading what Zola has done on each day of the week. She just loves the character of Zola.
And she likes the
Likewise,
next one as well, doesn't she? Like,
she
so she's
does.
not just rereading, she's
No,
waiting for the next book.
she is. And likewise, I just talked about Puffling by Margaret Wilde. She will go back and read that book over and over and over, and I suspect will read that one for the rest of her life. It is just, there is something new for her in that every time it's got a familiar friend in it, and she knows the story. But every time a child rereads a book, they're deepening their understanding of the language, of the story, of the writing techniques, of the way the illustrator has crafted part of the story in their illustrations. There's always something new. So I don't think we should discourage easy reading or rereading. If you are worried that your child is, say, sticking with Aussie Nibbles when they are well and truly able to read something a little more challenging, you might encourage them or challenge them to read something in between each of, say, the Aussie Nibbles or Solos or whatever they're stuck on at the moment. You might have a quiet word to their teacher librarian or to their classroom teacher. Sometimes I think it's a case of children aren't sure what to go on to next, so they've really, really loved, say, the Aussie Nibbles or the What Zola Did series, and they're just a bit like stuck, and they're like, I'm not sure what to read next. I just love Zola, or I just love Aussie Nibbles. I want to stay there. So sometimes a quiet word to a teacher librarian, you know, you can then segue them into something else that's similar, but maybe a little bit more challenging. Older siblings can be a great source of book recommendations as well. But no, I never discourage that kind of easy reading because it's comfort reading to me. And I think even as adults, we like to do a bit of, you know, every holidays I'll be reading a Donna Leon crime novel. Not much crime happens, but I'm there for the food.
You're always there for the food. Yeah, I think the other thing to do with this kind of stuff too is to see what their friends are reading, because sometimes like it is often that case of I don't know what to read next, so I'm going to stick to what I know. So it's not necessarily rereading, like it's not necessarily I'm going to reread the Treehouse series over and over again, but it's reading, you know, at a level across that, you know, that's kind of, they don't feel quite brave enough maybe to go up to the next thing, whatever the next thing might be. But sometimes the best way is actually to sort of ask around what are their friends reading, because if a friend is reading something that you think is about where, you know, your child could be, maybe try that, like, you know, oh, your friend Josh is reading this one, shall we give it a go, or can we borrow that when you're finished, or because that sometimes is just a way for them to be a little bit kind of braver, like
ask kids next read, you know, my child has really loved the What Zola Did by Melina Marchetta, what could she or he go on to read next?
Yeah, exactly. And I find it is a great question in that group, because there are so many people who can help. Like somebody came in the other day and they were asking about Toffel Towers by Tim Harris, and their child loves Toffel Towers by Tim Harris. I think they were based in the UK, and they didn't realise that Tim Harris had actually written several other, you know, series, and that some of those, you know, that's the other thing. Authors will often have, okay, there's Toffel Towers, but, you know, the next one up is Mr. Bambuckle's Remarkables, and it's a step up in, you know, kind of reading complexity. So if your kid loves that voice, well, maybe try to follow that voice, because often there will be a junior fiction series, and then perhaps that particular author has written middle grade, not the same series, but the same voice. You know, it's worth looking for what it is. Authors across the kind of, like Belinda Morell has, you know, the junior fiction series of Lulu Bell, and then she's got the one. What's the next one up?
You can read, oh, look, there's so many. And Pippa's Island,
that's the one I'm thinking of, which has got that sort of Lulu Bell vibe, but for an older audience.
Belinda Morell for quite some time.
Yeah, and then she's got the middle grade, Time Slips, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, it's worth looking at the author and then having, you know, having a chat to your librarian or your bookseller or whoever about what else has this person written, and trying that, because that's often a great way to kind of get, you know, just branch them a little bit sideways. All right, moving on, let us talk about let's talk about teacher librarians, because I believe you've got some quick tips for us area.
Well, I've had heaps of people emailing me recently. It's that time of year where people are thinking about what they're going to be doing next year. And I've had quite a few emails about becoming a teacher librarian, and should I become a teacher librarian, and what course do I need to do? So I thought I would give some quick tips on some things that I'd like you to consider. First thing is that library is a science and an art. Now, I was teaching library science at university level last semester, and it was all about the Dewey Decimal System, mark records, the Dublin Core Method, and controlled vocabularies. And it was it was actually a straight science subject with quite a few engineering students thrown in. So, you know, I need people to understand that library is a science, but it is also an art. Now, I am more towards the artistic end, but you have to do the science as well. So do keep that in mind. Lots of people ask, hey, will I get a job as a teacher librarian? Fair question. I'm just going to say that, yes, there are still teacher librarian jobs out there. No, there are not as many as there used to be, but you have to be the very best at what you do. And if you are, you will get a job, and you will continue to advocate for your role. I have been a teacher librarian for 20 years. I have been advocating for my job and what I do for that entire 20 years. And that's okay. And that's just part of what we need to do as teach librarians. Being a teach librarian, a lot of people say, I love reading. And I'm like, great. But being a teach librarian is not just about reading. It's about also teaching research skills, often ICT skills, and it's about resourcing the curriculum. That's a really big part of the job. So you have to like people, teachers in particular, and you must like collaboration.
Oh,
so you have
see,
to work.
I'd be terrible.
Yes.
There's group work involved, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot of group work. I sit in a heck of a lot of planning meetings with teachers and curriculum leaders where I am, my brain is just constantly going about, okay, they're talking about that. What resource could I find in the library, or what resource could I get that could fit that particular area of the curriculum? It's very much a resourcing job. And then you need to have, if you want to be a teacher librarian, so I'm talking here about a qualified teacher librarian, you need to have several degrees. You have to have a teaching degree first, and then you need to do a TL course, teach librarian course, or a librarianship course in order to be a what we would consider a fully qualified teacher librarian. So if you go to Students Need School Libraries, the website, and I will link that in the show notes, it tells you a lot more about A, why students need school libraries. It's got lots of information about school libraries in general. It's a great place to start. But if you are thinking about becoming a teacher librarian, I'm always going to say it is the best job in the world. I adore my job, but you've got to consider a couple of things. So I thought I would just share those tips about being a teacher librarian.
Those are great tips. Have you written a blog post about this? You need to put a blog post on Children's Books Daily about this.
I have not done that.
Well,
but,
you know, there's another job for you, right? You know, we'll just add that to your list.
I will.
Because our lists are just not long enough, I don't think, are they? I need to do a Dewey Decimal System on my list just so I can keep track of it. All right, I'm going to talk this week. I've got writing tips for kids. And this week I have got writing tips from the wonderful Kate Simpson. Now, Kate wrote this blog post for me, when was it? Last year. I had just read her picture book, which was new at the time. It's called Anzac Girl, The War Diaries of Alice Ross King. And I absolutely fell in love with it. And I shared it all over the place because it is so incredibly beautiful. It's quite a complex picture book. It's just incredible. It tells an emotional story. It's a personal history story. Kate is the great-granddaughter of Alice Ross King, and she has managed to distill this incredible wartime experience into this gorgeous picture book. It's great. Like, it's one of those ones if you are interested in just beautiful books but also in history and also, Aussie stuff, I thoroughly recommend it. But she wrote a post for me about where to find ideas for stories. Now, these are her writing tips for kids who might be wondering where ideas for stories come from. And trust me, all kids wonder about this because this is what we get asked more than any other question when we go to schools. So we go in on the front foot and we address it straight up. This is where the ideas came from. This is what you do with them. But she, because a lot of kids will be like, oh, I really like writing stories, but I just don't really have any ideas and I don't really know what to do. But as Kate points out, some of the best ideas for stories can be a lot closer to home than you think. She talks about, so her first tip is to embrace your family, which a lot of kids don't actually ever think that maybe story ideas might be actually within the family. So her picture book is the story of her great-grandmother, who was a nurse who left Melbourne to go to war and became the most decorated woman in Australia. She had this famous war hero in her own family. So she recommends asking, for kids to ask, whether there's anyone interesting in their family tree. Like, I know my dad is like, since he retired, he has gone through and done the family tree, and he's done the family tree all the way back as far as he can. And then he's done the family tree of everybody we married. And then he's done the family tree. He's at the point now, as my son says, I think Pops is at the point where if you meet him on the street and give him your name and your birthday, he goes and researches your whole family tree, which is quite true. Because, as Kate points out, if you've got a big family, it's going to be full of stories. It's going to be full of people that you might not meet in other parts of life. You might have that sort of the uncle who writes the angry letters to the paper. Let's face it, you might have a grandma who does that, and then sort of like reads them out, over Christmas lunch. Put him in a story. Maybe your
There's stories
second
everywhere.
cousin who won $10,000 playing the flute through her nose at a talent quest, as Kate says. She's a writer's dream. But every family has stories, and you may not get the whole story out of the family, but you're definitely going to get a character, or you might get a situation, and from that point you can jump off into a story. So her second tip is don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. So, if you come home with great ideas, you can use the real event as a story starter, and then it's your story at that point.
Springboard from
So
there.
don't feel like you have to stick to what actually happened to the uncle with the angry letters. You're just going to use him as a starting off point for your story. And as she said, if you've gone through your entire family history and the most exciting thing that anyone ever did was mix a red sock in with a load of white sheets, then you can look at other things. Like, is there a lizard living at the bottom of your backyard? What if it was a 1 meter long goanna and it snuck into your brother's room while he was asleep? Is there a gum tree behind your house? What if it was 100 meters high? What might you find at the top? So you're going to look around you and you're going to embellish, and you're going to think about how you can embellish the everyday stuff into an amazing story. And her third tip is to tune into your feelings, because stories need to be interesting, but they don't necessarily have to be epic adventures every single time. They need to make people want to turn the pages, but they don't have to involve car chases, monsters, or even 1 meter long goannas. Look at things where you can write a story about what happens in your life, but you want to talk about the feelings. And she talks about Beverly Cleary's Ramona books, and how it's one of her favorite children's book series. These are just ordinary kids doing ordinary things, but you feel everything that happens. When people read Beverly Cleary's books, they understand exactly what Ramona and her friends are feeling on every page. Have you ever wanted something really badly and didn't get it? Have you ever wished you could be just like the popular kids at school? Have you been embarrassed? Have you been sad? Have you been scared? Put it on the page, because that's where stories can be. If you can write about it honestly, then you have, one of the most amazing types of stories of all, which I think are great tips.
They're really good
Really
tips.
good tips. And I will put the link in the show notes at yourkidsnextread.com. There's a whole lovely post there, where to find ideas. They might be closer than you think, which I think is lovely. All right. Oh, gosh, that brings us to the end of another episode. How did we get here so quickly? This is extraordinary.
Yeah, it just happens, doesn't it? Yeah. What are you up to this week? Don't say more of the same.
I'm going to say more of the same. I really want to have exciting things to talk about. I really want to be doing amazing things, but I'm just not. And so, I'm learning to kind of live with that. And I think that there's a lot of people who've had to learn to live with it. So, it's going to get better, right? I'm going to have
It
the most amazing 2022. I'm going to have so many things to talk about. That's all I can say. But what have you got? What are you
is.
doing?
I'm doing something very close to home. We're making some mini gardens with the kids. We went to this fabulous nursery called Mappin's Nursery in West End in Brisbane. I spent an inordinate amount of money on, tiny plants and tiny figurines. But look, I loved repotting plants with my granddad and propagating plants as with my granddad as a small child and then with my parents. And I do think it's important in my world anyway that kids know the basics of gardening as opposed to having fake plants in the corner of their room. So we're making some little mini gardens, some little terrariums, some cactus gardens. I love doing that sort of thing.
Oh, it sounds lovely. We watched an episode of Making It Australia.
Oh, I keep meaning to watch that.
They did an episode, I think it was last week or maybe the week before, I can't remember. But it was about they had to make, oh, you would have been in heaven. They had to make a diorama.
Love
Oh,
a
I know.
diorama.
I look, honestly, you didn't even have to tell me that you loved a diorama. I just knew it. And I, of course, hate dioramas. But They had to make a diorama of their hometown, and so they had all different ways of doing it, and one person made like what basically looked like a terrarium of their sort of diorama. It
I'm
was
so
quite
gonna go and watch
extraordinary.
that. I could be on that show. That show is just so me. I know it.
Oh, you would. Well, we made a terrarium when Book Boy was about, I don't know, maybe 10, and he was right into the Hobbits and Lord of the Rings and stuff like that. And I actually ordered a craft kit, which had hobbits and little houses and things like that. And you put and a bit of, fake bits and pieces and a couple of plants, and you put it into a terrarium, and it was brilliant. It looked amazing. I really loved it. But of
I'm a
course, he
massive fan of
failed
small
to water it, so it died. But I
things.
still have the hobbit and the house, and I've just put them into a little pot plant that we have, down in our entry. Because I just love the idea. I do like coming home and knowing that there's a hobbit living under the mother-in-law plant.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Maybe I'll do a bit more of that. Maybe I can branch out of my from my more of the same and make it. I'll go from the outdoor gardening to the indoor gardening. There you go.
You should do that.
I should. All right. I guess
We'll
that's
talk
it.
again.
We'll talk again. Bye.
Bye.